sign.
Hey,
I see the sign.
Hang on, time's going now.
It's time for the Daily Review, a podcast dedicated to reviews and discussion of TV, movies, and books. Look for us at Daily Review on Facebook and Twitter and dailyreview.com on the web. That's DaleyReview.com.
This is Paul Daly here with my wife, Caroline.
Hey, guys.
And we're here to discuss the first episode of HBO's final season of The Leftovers. This one is called The Book of Kevin for very literal reasons, I believe.
Agree. So we have changed up our format a little bit. If you guys have been listening to us since our first season of The Leftovers so many years ago now, we are going to go a little bit more character by character, a lot less scene by scene. So you're not going to get a timeline from us where we start from the beginning and hit it all the way to the end, but we're absolutely going to hit the high points and we're going to talk a lot more about why these characters are doing what they're doing and a little bit less of like the moment by moment of what they're doing.
So with that in mind, we're going to hit the cold opening a little later and start with the GR and their fate. I think that the scene with the GR was a way for the producers of the show to say, whatever we're dealing with this season makes the GR look like a trifling triviality, and we might as well just erase them off the big board of potential enemies because you don't need to worry about them. They're toast.
So do you think that Evie and Meg are 100% officially gone? We will not see them again. Will we see them in flashbacks? Will we see anything else? Are they 100% goner?
Evie had some amount of chance because she saw everybody leaving. But the trouble was, we also saw the missile making its way right toward her in the reflection of her glasses. So I'm inclined to think they are dead. Like the GR is dead.
Do you think this is like a reasonable ending for Meg's character after all the time and energy that we had invested in her the last two seasons and everything with Tommy and, you know, giving her all that business, you know, humping him in that van and everything? Is this really the way she ends?
She knew something was coming right before the little spy camera poked in the side of the wall.
Thank God you told me what the heck that was, because I did not know why there was like a little screwdriver coming through the metal wall there. And then Paul's all like, that's what the SWAT team does. They like start peeping around on people.
So she knew something. But when we jump forward with Kevin and we get to see what the Welcome Center became after the missile strike, she would have needed to really jackrabbit out of there pretty seriously.
And she did not look like she had any indication that she was making a run for it. What did you think of her Siegfried and Roy conversation?
I think that they, the GR, or at least her chapter of it, were Siegfried and Roy tempting fate, poking at White Tigers, aka the rest of us. And sooner or later, we were going to swat them back. And that's what happened.
Or bite their faces off, as Meg says.
Yes.
We might have melted their faces off. They have to be identified by dental records.
Yeah. Well, you know, those missile strikes.
That's serious business. So how do you feel? Like, all right, so GR officially off the books. We are moving on to some other topics. That's
right.
How we feel like it's going to go here. There may be some flashbacks because we did have a couple of flashbacks. But for the most part, I really think that that portion is done. And I'm okay with that, I think. I mean, I tried to think for a minute, like, am I going to miss any business with those guys? But to be honest, the second that Evie picked up that pad and started like writing, like, what are we doing? I started kind of feeling a little like, oh, man, I don't know if I want to be doing this part, you know?
The GR in both season one and season two, you know, represented an escalating threat, but it was still on the level of what you might call local trouble.
They're like essentially like hoodlums.
This season, I think the scope has been brought into a global level.
Given the cold open, I would say like even expanding the timeline. We had a lot of similarities with opening our minds to a much larger space and time kind of feel when we were looking at the cavewoman in season two's first episode. And so I feel like a lot like, you know, going back to expanding our brains into like, you know, this concept might have to do with even just the entire human experience, you know? Mm-hmm. This is exciting. Speaking of time, we have a time jump that happens right after this missile explosion of the GR.
A time jump, which this podcast predicted a year ago. We thought this was the most logical way to make the story move forward. We bet that it would be kind of cool to see Kevin, you know, regain the town. But ultimately, this show is not about knocking heads. This is a show about characters doing emotional character stuff. And so jumping forward to the next most interesting point in all their lives would make more sense than seeing Chief Kevin pick up the reins again.
Right. So we did get to see Chief Kevin, but it wasn't exactly when he picked up the reins. It was like when he was actually ensconced on his horse, ready to go, right?
Right, right.
And we had talked about that. We really thought that Lily was going to be a character. And so we were guessing it to be when she was maybe about 5 years old, which I think if you do the math, I think Lily was still pretty small. She was probably only like one, but it's 3 years later.
3 years, yes.
And so she technically somewhere in the universe would be around 4 or 5 years old. So I feel pretty good that we kind of caught on to all of their little tips and tricks here about where they might head next. We actually catch up with them on Tommy's birthday. And I have to say that Tommy was hardly recognizable. I swear to God, at first I thought it was like Rick Schroeder.
Well, you know, Chris Zilka has been hanging around with Paris Hilton in his time off. So he's stepped up his game, I would say.
You think so?
Yeah.
Yeah. So turns out, I guess he's supposed to be turning 25 because during the birthday party there, they were talking about where were you at 25? How do you feel like this conversation was supposed to be read by us, the audience?
I think it was about Kevin's story and Matt's conclusion about Kevin's story, or at least the conclusion he was trying to get Kevin to make. The idea, Kevin initially called it divine intervention, but he came around to thinking, well, maybe it's more of a right place, right time kind of thing, which when you just mentioned the season two opener, seems like a lot of the same thing, doesn't it? The baby should have died right there, but instead another woman came along and found the baby and took it away from danger. Almost the same story as Kevin meeting Lori as they described it there.
I like it. I think that makes a ton of sense. Also felt like them touching on how Kevin and Lori met really pushed us into a different place for like, you know, we really like abandoned that family, you know, who was Kevin, Lori, Tommy, Jill. We really don't talk about them as like any type of nuclear group anymore, which was such the heavy focus of season one and two. And now it's like so much more expanded, you know, now yeah. We're going to be talking about several reveals that happened in that birthday party with them mentioning that John and Lori were married. Was that like, what the what?
That I couldn't have guessed. I mean, I did guess that Erica was not sticking around.
Right. And that's fair because, dude, there's no way.
But I didn't see the former Mrs. Garvey finding a reason to stay in Jardin, really.
Her personality was so much more like lighthearted in this episode than we've seen her at all that I was real interested how the two of them would have gotten together.
Lori, for me, this episode, she just has a little bit, but I think it's a pretty interesting extension of the path that she started in the first season, right? She was a member of the GR. She comes to believe the GR is bullshit, I guess. And then in season two, we catch up with her and she's using her training as a psychiatrist, but with this kind of layer of cynicism.
Well, and very directly trying to take apart and dismantle the GR. So yeah. She's trying to do it in this very sinister in some way, if you looked at it from the GR point of view.
It's like those people that write the I was in Scientology books, kind of. She was doing the same thing, but for the GR.
I thought it was super interesting that then it turned out that John and Lori are running this entire scam. That was so weird when we were having these moments of really sort of these, they weren't flashbacks, but they were like callbacks to our previous season. So having like the handprint moment happening.
Right.
I mean, I didn't think it was going to be our original handprint master, but at the same time, I was gobsmacked that it was John. He was completely the one in previous season saying like, this is the craziest thing and totally wrong.
Burn your house down for doing this here.
Exactly. And so here they are doing it. When it turned out that, you know, you could tell that he was getting this information from Lori and we were like, oh man, she must be getting it from Facebook. And then they totally like zoomed in on Facebook. I was like, oh my God. Like, this is crazy town. What do you think is the possible reason that they are running this scam? At first you thought, well, maybe money, right? Because they always have had this $80 situation. But then John comes up there and totally shreds it. What in the world?
It's what I was saying about her mix of desire to be of service, maybe, but then with that added cynicism, where like last season, she moved from being just a sit-down therapist to more of like P.T. Barnum with Tommy's healing hugs, which pissed Tommy off. So moving on to the handprint scam is like a perfect next step.
That's really awesome. Yeah, it's super logical, right? So,
yeah.
So it's like she always has to have like a hook now in order to basically sit down and talk with people.
It's the same rationale as with Tommy, which is, hey, as long as they feel better afterwards, what's the diff? And I think that's how she's operating now, just on a person-by-person basis.
So given that John and Lori are handling it this way and they're shredding the money, and Lori kind of even like rolled her eyes, like kind of like, what are you going to do? He's going to shred the money. Clearly, John is not the chief of fire anymore, it appears. So what the what? How, like, the two of them are just doing what? How is this all working out for them?
Maybe she takes regular clients
on the side.
Yeah.
That makes sense. I'll go with you on that. That's how she's bringing in the bucks. I like it. I like it. So going back to Tommy's birthday party, which was an amazing, really like trampoline to be on because there was so much action going on and we were getting so much information just kind of popping off from it. I loved the structure of it, of bringing the people together for this party and then how all this information was kind of coming out of interacting.
Were you at all reminded of Kevin Sr.'s birthday in season
one? I absolutely was. Yeah.
I was also, because it was a lot of the same people. Clearly, that's how family birthdays work, but still just, you know, this show's only going to have 28 episodes and we've got two birthday parties. So,
and kind of a lot of like the same kind of like making a speech of the birthday guy. And then there's sort of being this always that sort of, because it's the leftovers, there's always going to be a little bit of like tension slash awkwardness of something that's happening. Jill coming in on the scene the way that she did was like, hello, Jill.
Yeah. See, you've picked your best carpet to wrap around yourself and wear out this evening.
Oh, my God. So apparently she's a college student. Yes. She
decided
to head off to school.
I would bet so.
Remarkable. So Jill really turned a corner here in many ways.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hello. She was at the GR station.
Well, yeah, that's right. Last season, we didn't see her interact with school at all, even though she was apparently school-aged. And we knew that from the first season, she started to stop caring about grades and that kind of stuff. So yeah, this is a huge turnaround for
and
Jill.
Like, and almost like a very normal path for Jill. Like, not meaning normal, like, that's of course where she would go, meaning like, that's a very mainstream path for kind of an alternative girl at this point.
And it's a normal path in a pre-departure world, which is not where this show exists.
And I mean, we only saw Jill for like a tiny moment, but she had a huge reveal for us when she was saying, does Nora talk about Lily?
Yeah, that brought up the big question. What happened to Lily? Does it have anything to do with that cast? The way they said it, it's the way you say it when someone dies.
Freaky. I can't think that it has to do with the cast just because they're way too lighthearted about that cast. You know, Kevin saying stuff like, you know, oh, I'm going to miss that cast when it's gone. And she's all like, well, you never even asked to sign it. Like, I can't imagine if that was
the death cast.
The death cast. That they would possibly be so cavalier about it. But I wonder, I mean, and there was that moment of realness between him and Jill when she asked Kevin, does she talk about Lily? And then him saying no, but then pausing and being like, you know, should I make her talk about it? You know, kind of thing. It was like, wow. Kevin is really still not playing that true father role with Jill. You know, there's still that dynamic of like asking Jill's advice in some way, you know, where that's really changed. Because, you know, at the very beginning of this whole thing, it was definitely like he's dad, she's kid, you know, everything. And now where you have this really different feel between them where Kevin is a lot more vulnerable and even with Jill, you know, very vulnerable and talking to her like, you know, what do you think? Should I be asking about, you know,
yeah.
Like, wow, what a change in everybody. Matt played his usual role at these kind of get-togethers for me, where I feel like he always has like kind of something a little bit funny to say every once in a while, you know? He doesn't always get to be the comic relief, but sometimes he has these like really funny stories. I kind of loved his burning bush story, where he was like talking at the birthday about how, you know, his Spanish is not so good, but he thinks the burning bush was saying, put me out.
Yeah.
Like they are so funny. And these shows are so layered with things that like you could go and look up literally like every single line of things that have happened in this episode and every single one of the leftovers. This season in particular, I feel like they're doing an amazing job. For good or for bad, I don't know how you want to look at it. If you want to say like, I wasn't planning on spending like 8 hours a day, you know, reading on everything about what's going on in the leftovers, they are putting out content like mad with all the director's interview, like with Mimi Leader.
Mm-hmm.
Damon, they have a whole interview with him about like, why did they have that Gary Busey blow up doll?
Why did they have Gary Busey?
We're going to put it on the website, Paul, because I cannot explain every single part that they put out there, but there is so much out there explaining everything from the cold open to every single part. There's like, here's 6 things that you missed in this episode of The Leftovers and like little tiny callbacks. The layering in this down to, for me, when Kevin is wearing the crown outside, oh my gosh, could there have been like more calls to him being Jesus in this episode? It was crazy. So let's talk about Matt a little bit. He has some pretty major changes going on in his world.
He's apparently been promoted to big pastor in town. If you recall, last season, he was basically cleaning the pews. And this year, people are lining up outside the church, listening to a loudspeaker like North Koreans listening to Kim Jong-un or something. I mean, it is, they're just standing there kind of mouth agape, listening to him talk about the importance of 7 in the Bible. And that we are coming up on the 7th anniversary of the sudden departure. And maybe that's going to mean something.
How do you feel about this new approach of his? Like in the past, he's always been like, you know, this is the way it is. This is the way it is. How did you feel about the fact that he just twisted that a little bit? And he was like, I'm not saying anything is going to happen. But if it was going to happen, it probably is going to happen here. Because it's miracle.
That might be the result of a studied interest in what wasn't working before and how to change it. Because if you recall, his congregation in Mapleton was nil.
Right. He had no one at all.
And here he has a thriving following.
I feel like there's a huge change in Miracle itself as a town. And I feel like it has a lot to do with Matt in that they no longer had to have the wristbands and no longer had to be doing all the registration. Now, there's no welcome center to do your said registration.
Yes. Yeah, the park service was nowhere to be found.
It just doesn't exist in the same way anymore.
And somehow, yeah, a police department was created.
We were so lucky to be able to be there before they took down any of the sets in Lockhart. And we have a lot of really great up-close pictures of the formation there of the police department and the Jardin whole police station. And you can get really close up. We were able to take pictures through the glass there of like, you know, all the different wanted posters and the different evidence boxes and all this kind of stuff. And it's really cool and fun
to look at that stuff because, you know, there were file folder boxes stacked up in the windows. And if you looked at what it was written on there, it would say something like murder evidence from some case. And if you looked up the name that was on the case, it would always be some leftovers staffer, like a costume designer or production assistant or something. So we went and used a telephoto lens and took all the pictures we could get clearly through this 100-year-old storefront glass, which isn't always perfectly clear, and did our best to look up who might be on the other end of these pictures.
So definitely check out dailyreview.com and take a look at the finer details of the town and what became that police department, because it was really interesting how you kind of felt like there were these little moments of sort of, I'm going to say like goodbyes and thank yous to staffers and things that are already happening in episode 1. You know, it's like, how can you get people's names into the show? Like if you only have 8 episodes and you know this is your final season, they're already doing it. You know, like it's already happening in these layers. Always love the leftovers for that. So back to old Matt, we feel like things are going well. You know, he introduced Mary and Noah, his son, and they were standing up there and everything was going great. And then later in the episode, we find out actually things are not going so great. And Mary is feeling extremely, almost like a hostage, she makes it sound.
Yeah.
She's not allowed to leave the city limits. This wasn't a shock to me because I know how worried he was about the situation. Mm-hmm. What is this founded, do you think? Or do you think Match just, would she have woken up anyway elsewhere? Or was this the amazing tale of miracle and her waking up?
I think we're going to find out if she all of a sudden becomes comatose after she leaves Jardin. I'm inclined to believe that there is some specialness to the place. Yeah, I choose to believe that. The place was spared the departure by more than just some numerical freak of nature, and that different special things can happen there, including Kevin finding his way back from death. And Mary, you know, we saw her in the International Assassin Hotel, so she was somehow involved with the other place. We know that if you play your cards right, if you sing the right karaoke song, you can come back. Will it shut off when she leaves? That would be kind of cruel. But the stuff that he was saying about Kevin not being able to die there, I think that might be kind of true.
So super duper interesting. I thought the part when Mary was like, you know, he's writing a book about you, Kevin.
That was a mic drop.
Yeah, that was definitely the type of situation where if you were going to be leaving your husband like this and the other person's like, you know, I don't know, your husband's a pretty good guy. And you turn and you say, hey, you know, all those secrets that you're trying to keep, he's writing a book about you. That's a really good way for Kevin to turn around and be like, did you need money for the train? Like, right. I understand now and I support you running. We have an extra suitcase you can borrow and you can stay in my house back in Mapleton. So it definitely seemed like the type of thing that Kevin was 100% on board there. I always kind of forget that Nora's her sister-in-law. Them sitting there and talking wasn't just about Mary leaving her husband. Nora is, for all you guys who might be just joining us or not remembering, Nora is Matt's sister. So when you think about that, that conversation was really personal and really like, it wasn't just two women kind of complaining about their husband, you know?
Right.
Like she was coming to her sister-in-law to say goodbye and all that. I don't know. For some reason that kind of, again, for The Leftovers, there's always sort of these moments for me of like, I watch it and I absorb it and then I like soak it in again later. Like, hang on a minute. Those weren't just like two women who are like in the show. That was totally like her sister-in-law. She was like saying goodbye. The little boy that Nora obviously is in love with and, you know, was like hugging on everything. And Mary's coming to say like, I'm taking Noah and we're leaving, you know, for Nora. And his name's Noah, by the way. This is like, how many children now? Number four that she's like loving on and that are like being taken away.
Because we've all seen the season 3 trailer, you know, and so it's not a spoiler to mention things that happen in the trailer. And one of those things that happened was that weird voice on the phone saying, do you want to see your family again? So if they build up this kind of you keep losing children thing inside this woman who desperately seems to want to be a mother, that's going to be a really hard moment.
It's really sad, right? I mean, like, really think about that. Like, I mean, that is, my God, like the second she loves on somebody like that, you know, I mean, and Kevin, good Lord, Kevin's only like 50-50 on his whole ability to stay in the here and now. I don't know. I really feel for Nora. This is getting to be like really a crazy time for her. Especially, you know, with Mary leaving, that would also be like a support person for her in theory. You know, if something did happen to Kevin, it would be reasonable for her to go that way. Overall, like with this book of Kevin and Michael working on it as well. And, you know, this entire situation, I knew that when Kevin like went and did that confrontation with Matt in the church, there was like no way he was burning that book. Like there was.
Oh, you didn't?
No way. No way he was burning that book. No way.
Bold. I was not sure.
Really? You really thought that it would be gone? If it was gone, then did you think there was a backup copy or something? Like, there's no way.
Kevin has been given a magic book before, and he didn't want anything to do with it.
Yeah, but it never went away. We have one here in the office.
Oh my God, it's over there.
We do have that National Geographic that we had signed by most of the cast. And it is like still one of those things. I can't wait to go back through it now. Now I'm kind of wondering if the cold open information might have been in there, we would have looked right past it, you know?
That's true.
It'd been like super lame. Moving on.
I'm not sure Australia's in there, but we'll have to double check.
So you did not think that that book, I think it is like the National Geographic that won't let him alone. Like, I just don't think it's going to die. Even if he had put it in that barbecue barrel, I honestly think like the barrel would have tipped over or like one of those things. Like, I think that the book of Kevin, it's symbolic for me of him trying to walk away or abandon the story that is his.
Okay.
And the reality is that his story, for some reason, in this town, cannot die. His whole being cannot die. And so for him, it just seems like one of those things where I don't know how it would die. You know, I don't know how this book or this story would ever be destroyed.
It adds a little extra layer to that scene when he comes in to yell at Matt about the flyer and he tosses his aviator sunglasses on the book. And when he picks it up, the camera shows him pick it up. But if you watch it again, you'll see, oh, that's obviously the book. And clearly, he might have even come into this office and seen that book 1,000 times, you know?
He probably has. He probably has. Well, Kevin and everything that he experienced this, in all these seasons, really kept coming back into play for us. There was a ton of flashbacks. And I was trying to think, like, is he the only one that experienced a flashback? And I think it was just him. There were so many little moments. It kind of felt like a little bit of like a, almost like a finale in a lot of ways, how like old characters came back in on the scene and their stories came to a conclusion. Like, It was weird how that happened. Like, you know, like Meg and Evie, we like immediately dealt with them and like their stuff kind of came to a close. And with Mary, like Mary, like comes or goes or whatever. It's like, remember that thing that's been happening this whole time? We're going to bring that character in. They're going to be here for like 2 seconds and we're going to like maybe try to tie up their story a little bit. We have a ton of like good ones that are like good new storylines that I feel like have been laid out. But one that I was shocked as hell was freaking Dean Dog Killer. Did you ever in a million bobillion expect that this dude was coming back in on the scene here?
No. And that's primarily because I didn't think he was completely human. I didn't know that he was just a traveling caterer or whatever it was he says that he was. In season one, the way that he showed up out of nowhere and just seemed to know things about Kevin and do things like leave him his truck and stuff like that, stuff that people don't normally do. I was inclined to think that there was something supernatural about him. And this makes it seem like, no, he's more of a nut. He's just sort of a guy that likes killing dogs. And
I don't know. I'm still going to stick with your, there's something supernatural about him just because of him finding Kevin. I feel like the concept of Satan or this bad guy or whatever, that he doesn't have to come in the way that you expect. And in fact, the more that he comes in looking a little bit like just a crazy guy who maybe you don't have to pay that much attention to, and then you don't even realize how bad it is, I kind of think that's how it played out. First of all, this scene with him with the sandwich, oh my God, when he brought up that igloo cooler and he put on those plastic gloves, there's no way that anyone in the free world who has ever, ever seen someone with plastic gloves and a cooler did not think a body part was in there.
That's the classic carry.
That's how device. You bring the yes. organs, right? Right? Anywhere. That's how they do it. And, you know, if you've seen Seven, you might think it's a head, right?
You might. Yeah. So no one I can think of would have seen a peanut butter sandwich coming.
No. And the entire story of, you know, that the dogs are taking over the planet and dogs are turning into humans. As crazy as it sounds, and I adore how Kevin played it. You know, he listened and the whole, you know, that's how they get their hands on the button. And he's all, no, paw. That's how they get their paw on the button.
Great delivery.
So hard. Oh my God, I laughed so hard. We were like, Kevin, I love you and you are hysterical. But the whole idea of say he really is Satan, right? Say he really is something evil, some really horrible force. And how you like laugh him off, right, in some way, and you don't really take the threat seriously. And then that comes back again, but in a way more serious way. That kind of feels a little how Satan would be. He's not like a straightforward kind of sitch, like come to the dark side. He's like, here I have this story. Like, do you want to believe in this? You know, and sort of like pulling. And then the idea that the next time you see him, he's like trying to blow your head off seems like, yeah, no, that kind of seems how Satan would play shit, right?
Yes, I agree. Kevin has existed on, let's just maybe say, three different planes of existence in this show. He's been on the same level as everybody else. He's been in the other place where the hotel lives. But then in season one in particular, he had at least one dream that I can think of that was meant to be some kind of precognition foreshadowing, but it involved the dog killer. If you remember, he had to wake up because his fence was burning down, but the dog killer was in that weird scene. My point to bring that up is I kind of think we're going to see the dog killer again, but on one of those other planes that Kevin can seem to access.
I like that. I mean, I think that it would make complete sense. And that's why I'm like not in a place where I'm like, oh, no, the dog killer is just, you know, he's just a guy and he tracked him down and everything. I don't feel like that's how this world works at all. And I do think, even talking about dogs and everything, you know, like it's very like Cerberus and very, you know, like hounds from hell and like all this kind of talk. Like, I don't know. There's something to the whole thing of acting like maybe it's not as direct as he's saying, like you would find canine DNA in this sandwich type of thing. But maybe the concept of evil and, you know, sort of the infiltration of bad stuff getting into people and people starting to do bad and weird things too. Maybe that's a possibility. Maybe there's a symbolism there that is worth considering.
And I've read or seen different stories suggesting that when things of a supernatural nature exist on our plane for too long, they kind of lose their shit because this isn't really their home or their place. And they're not really supposed to stay here that long. They're supposed to come in, make trouble and go back to Olympus or something like that.
Right.
The fact that Dean is still here doing catering jobs and he goes a little nuts kind of fits that mold.
Well, and I also think that the idea that they have always used animals to symbolize things in the show, you know, whether it be the deer representative of the journey of the hero. Maybe it's on the very smallest level, like talking about the dogs again, and now Kevin's on this kind of journey again, you know, like something you know, something new is going to happen. That's how the season's going to start. He's going to have a new story. There's sort of that feeling back to, you know, hitting the deer and, you know, remembering blasting the dogs, and that started him down a crazy path, basically with Dean, you know?
Yeah.
So there is something to bringing in animals and bringing in that part of nature.
Well, there was a lot of focus on birds this episode.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to see more animals because this episode reminded me of a lot of other episodes of The Leftovers.
That's what I mean about it having a little of a feel of a finale where it's like sometimes they will pull, like there's these callbacks and they'll pull and remind you like in a nostalgic kind of way. And they did it very literally with the flashbacks where, you know, they showed him at the well pushing in Patty, or they showed him actually a lot of scenes from the assassin episode, but there's a lot to that. But even shooting the dog and even his experience with Dean, there is a lot there, but even just those little moments, like you're saying, where there's just the feeling of a previous episode or feeling of a previous scene.
Yeah.
I felt the exact same way. I wonder if this 8-episode season is really going to feel like an 8-hour finale in many ways to us, because I feel like there's a lot of that wrapping up, those reminders, pulling the stories back from other places and putting it back into place. It has that, which is amazing. I feel like we're going to experience like an 8-hour movie, you know, where it's going to feel so full and rich. And I love that about this.
And I think Kevin, without even knowing it, feels the same way, because he had some trouble differentiating his past real life exploits with things that happened in the other place. And he legit didn't seem to know the difference.
Okay, so let's talk about that a little bit. There was definitely moments when like the dog killer popped up and shot when they were driving the patrol car. Whoa. First of all, blown away. I love Mimi Leder. I love her directing. I love the way that that scene just felt like it just blasted you in the face, literally, you know, It was so remarkable. And for a moment when Kevin calls out to Tommy and like, you don't see Tommy, how like insane did that feel?
I identified it with Kevin's loss of control of the situation. I mean, I felt like something else has to intervene here to save him, because the dog killer has gone off the deep end here, and he's in your face with a loaded rifle.
Did you worry for a moment though that Tom had been shot?
No, not shot. Just, you know, they were in a car wreck. You know, he might have been pinned behind a airbag or stuck in some way or knocked out. But nope, Tommy rose to the occasion.
It made me wonder actually how much he shared with his family as a whole, and who knew what. And what's considered real and what's not considered real. Because I assume the fact that he doesn't want to share the Book of Kevin's story means that he doesn't want to talk about any of those things as if they happened. Yeah. That's what you would assume, right?
Yeah.
But then when he talks with Tom and he's like, you need to go get help because now you've shot someone and, you know, I've killed people. Let me like tell you about that. And he told about killing the bodyguards of Patty and basically killing this woman, Patty, and everything. Yeah. You know, like, uh-oh. Like, did you start hearing that, like, where's my mind starting to play?
Well, until he mentioned the bodyguards, he had a role in Patty's real life death. That's not what he meant, though.
No, he said he shot a woman. And so, I mean, that was a different scenario. Now, I mean, speaking of Patty and speaking of that entire scene, if you recall the bag over her head situation, I feel like maybe he was reenacting some of that with the bag over his head scene.
You know, I totally forgot about that until you mentioned it. I've been trying to make sense of what that scene actually means. Yeah, that makes sense. It's almost like whether or not he wants to atone for Patty, and he goes up right to that second where he's going to decide, okay, I'm just going to die this time, or no, I'm going to rip the bag because, you know, it's just a thin bag and nothing's holding my hands from doing that, you know?
And is that what you think happens? He starts his day, you know, Nora goes off on a bike ride, and he starts his day by getting out the cufflink box, which if I remember correctly, the handcuffs were also kept in that cufflink box or something very similar.
Okay.
Which, if you remember, for anybody who's not remembering past seasons, and I know not all of you have to watch it 700 times like we do, that's how Nora kept him grounded, basically kept him here, literally, you know, cuffed him to her so that there's no wandering. Well, in many ways, this whole situation for him, I felt like, oh gosh, the same box and this idea of this reliving of this, actually, it was like doing the opposite. Like I felt like in many ways it was sucking him into this other world, but maybe allowing him to stay grounded in where he was. It's like people who have to, like, I don't know, cut themselves or something to like relieve it a little bit. It's like he has to have this moment in the morning where he like puts the bag on his head, and I don't know if he chooses to bring himself back or if he just sees if he dies or not. You know, it's possible that he loses all the oxygen and then he opens his eyes and realizes like, nope, didn't work. You know, like, I don't know that he ever rips the bag. They don't show that. My guess is that he never dies.
Mm.
And so I feel like maybe it's a morning check. Like, can I die today? Nope.
So
off to work, you know. But here's one question I do have with that. If he's so invincible and everything's so cool, why does he wear what appears to be like a bulletproof vest every day?
That's a good question, because he doesn't seem to be adhering strictly to a police officer's uniform. So
I think it was kind of weird. It's got to come into play. But I don't get why he would wear it. I didn't notice Tommy wearing it.
I think it's very normal for cops to wear bulletproof vests.
But I didn't see Tom wearing it, what I'm saying. The most part, though, under your shirt?
I mean, you could see his shirt. So.
No, it was on top of his shirt. You couldn't see the shirt buttons. It was on top of his shirt. I don't know. Take a look at it. It's one of those things that's like, I'm not really quite sure. Like, if he can't die, I don't know why he would be wearing a bulletproof vest, period.
I mean, his recovery from that bullet wound wasn't automatic. He wasn't like Wolverine or anything.
Yeah, but it's 3 years later. I mean, I don't know if you're trying to say like that's some sort of healing.
It's still a massive inconvenience to go through getting shot, I would say, even if you are immortal.
I'm with you. I don't know. I thought it was odd for a man who's like some kind of in this immortality place. Speaking of, we have this entire baptism scene. And again, it seems like he's like testing his immortality.
That's true. That is how I read that. I mean, he has a history with this place, obviously. This is another place that won't let him die. It would rather have an earthquake and send all the water away than let Kevin Garvey die in it. So this is a pretty safe place to jump in.
Again, he's wearing like a bulletproof vest. The water may or may not have been poisoned. And he was wearing, if they weren't true cowboy boots, they were sort of what we consider like kicker boots here in Texas, which are sort of a little bit like really heavy work boots. They look sort of like cowboy boots, but they're like this other kind of rancher kind of shoe that they wear. Here's the main thing you need to know. They're heavy, really, really heavy. And so jumping in the way he did like that, I swear to God, I mean, even if you were the best swimmer ever, you would not pop up like right away at all. I mean, you would have to struggle to come back to the surface. So the fact that he does with a bulletproof vest and those super heavy boots basically pop up like a cork. Yeah, this is some amazing immortality. Not only that, but again, we don't know and we're trying to figure out. I guess there'd be certain toxins that you'd be able to smell, like if it was maybe like ammonia or something that had a very, very strong smell. But for the most part, the way to check the water does not seem to be with your face and your mouth, right, folks? We might just take a water sample and go check it at like your local pool supply store and find out what kind of chemicals were in the water. But I don't think I would be offering to suck it up with my mouth.
No. And the way he jumped in was very dangerous also.
Tell me, what did you think? We've been to that little area.
It's just not that deep. So jumping in, not in a cannonball fashion, I think
you felt like you could break your legs?
Break your legs, yeah. Especially with all that extra weight on. I read it like another
just a
immortality
test. And a little like him. He didn't care. Like if he did die right then, so bees. When you test, you want to think that maybe you're hoping for a specific outcome in some way. Like you would jump to like prove to yourself you couldn't die. Mm-hmm. But like the way he even did it, where he was kind of like you said, like kind of resigned. Like, I'm just going to jump like a pencil into here. Live or die. Let's see. You know, just like, yeah. I also thought that scene with Michael then, with him, the baptism scene and accepting Jesus in your heart, that didn't count.
Yeah.
That was a pretty amazing and I think a big deal.
I think he went through with it because Michael and Matt are his friends and he doesn't want them to look bad
in front
of their group. And
but if you go through the trouble of saying that doesn't count, that's the part where I'm saying like you would just do it, maybe give him a look like you're welcome kind of thing, you know, like I just like play acted that and mm-hmm. whatever. It seemed like a step further to bother to say that. And I'm kind of wondering if it's one of those, there's a big part of the Bible that's about denying God and about those sort of betrayal kind of moments. When you have that kind of stuff, It shows up to me like, ooh, that's something to pay a little attention to.
I think I might think of it like this. Even though he has gone to the other side and come back and gone through these adventures and seen what he's seen, guess that since none of that so far, including the departure, has matched up to any kind of religious representation of the Almighty, then he has fallen into some religious apathy where, like, you know, if something definitive comes along, maybe I'll believe that. But so far, nothing seems to make sense or match up with anything anyone's ever taught me. So forget it all. You know, it all goes in the same bucket of meaninglessness.
I just don't think that for a story that is often pulled from Bible moments, denying Jesus or denying God is a moment for a character. Like you have to stop and pay attention to that when that happens.
Okay.
And if it turns out that there's like three times he does it and then something else happens, I'm going to not be surprised.
Speaking of denying,
that last scene with Nora, and a lot of people didn't even recognize that was Nora. They're now calling her Sarah. And we should have known it was her as soon as she starts riding that bike.
Right. The foreshadowing from earlier in the episode when she says, I'm going on a bike ride.
And then you were mentioning in the book, she was like a constant bike rider.
She was always riding her bike in the book. Yes.
So then that was like, oh, man, we should have known it right away before she even turned around. The way that they had her dressed, honestly, it could have been a man or a woman. But then when she turned around and they said, oh, you know, do you know the name Kevin? And she said, no, the way she did.
Yeah. Something happened. Something major happened. Those weren't even Nora's mannerisms or anything. I mean, usually, whether or not you believe, people are still nice to nuns, normally.
Right.
And she was just like cold shoulder queen.
Exactly. What do you think about this dropping off of the birds biz?
Well, there was one aspect of it that reminded me of Lost, which was when she took the little messages out of their carrier devices and just chucked them away. That reminded me of the very important reports that came out of that one Dharma station that just wound up in a pile.
Yeah, the tube.
Yes. The second thing was that thing that she was collecting the birds in. It looked just like the same thing, the same birdhouse from the opening.
So that pulls us back to the opening. And there was a lot of people who really felt like both of those were standalone scenes. Like, I don't understand what was happening with Nora at the end. And then you heard a lot of like, I don't understand what was happening at the beginning. And I look at them as like one and the same. Like, this is a continuation of one scene, really. And so if you guys have an opportunity to go get on Google and type in The Great Disappointment of 1844, you will find out so much. It is amazing to me how The Leftovers always goes to real life events that none of us would have ever heard of. I had no idea that the Seventh-day Adventist Church was spurred on by the event of the Great Disappointment of 1844.
I didn't really even know that there was a Great Disappointment, or that the Great Disappointment was a year after something more like a more mild disappointment, when an original prediction toward the end of the world didn't come true. Then this guy Miller was like, well, actually, I miscalculated. It's the same day, but it's next year. So that's why it became 1844, which you can see 1844 figures prominently in the chalkboard scrawlings of the preacher at the beginning of the episode.
It's amazing to me how much there is there. It's way too meaty for us to get into. And I know you're probably driving your car listening and you say, oh, just read that Wikipedia article to me. But it is very lengthy. The main thing that I feel like is this idea that for many, 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 many generations of recorded history, we have this strange need as humans to be like the group that is going to be here when the world ends.
Yeah.
Whether that be, you know, in 1844 or, you know, as soon as it was going to hit Y2K, we were all going to explode. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, we take some sort of pride as humans. Like, it's probably going to happen when I'm here. Like, I'm going to be the last man standing.
Apparently, the first crop of people that had that belief came right after Christ died. They thought, he's definitely coming back within my lifetime.
Think about that. There's this really huge fascination for us as a human race. Sometimes for groups, it seems like it's this preparatory thing. Like, I need to be prepared for the end of the world. So therefore, I'm like stockpiling food, or I'm really interested in conservationism because I really want to prolong till we get to the end of the world. But there's a huge fascination and a strange ego thing that has to do with us being the last one. Now, maybe it's that if you're the guy that's stuck in the middle, it's like everyone remembers the first guy that did something, and pretty much everyone remembers like the last thing that happened before the switchover, right? Whatever the switchover is. Mm-hmm. And if you're anybody in between, you didn't really matter.
Yeah.
So the last thing, as all of us know, we weren't the first people here on Earth. The only notoriety any of us could really, really have then is to be the last person. Because the guys who was like, you know, second to last, or the generation right before the Earth died, nobody's going to remember you.
Right.
You don't really do anything. We don't really care about you, right?
I read some of the inspiration here, and Damon basically says it has to do with just the narcissism of every generation of mankind, thinking that they're definitely the most important in one way or another. And it just goes perpetually. It has for 2,000 years, apparently.
Do you think it has to be that way? Just like for the reason I said? Because otherwise, you can't just consider yourself a stepping stone for the next generation. That's crap. I'm not just the facilitator for the next one to be the great one, right? Like, we have to be it.
Well, do you think that figured in the man's decision to leave his wife at the beginning? Like, we've got to get on with our lives and
that's a really good question. I mean, I thought hard about that whole situation. I mean, obviously there is a huge link to Lori and Kevin and their kids and what happened there. You could look at it like the man left his wife and left with the kid, or you can look at it like the woman continued to do something that was like crazier and crazier, right? And
she
crazier.
Was this devout person.
Right. And he kind of like, more like he like called it earlier than she did, you know, like, so yeah. not like he walked from her. If she had turned around and was like, oh my gosh, yeah, like this, I can't just keep doing this. I can't keep going further and further down this path. like Lori, getting, I'm sure, further and further into the GR, I think it would have been fine. Their family would have been fine. He didn't like leave her. But I think at the finally, too, the humiliation that he was feeling, the husband, of like, my God, my wife is still going up there and still going for this, even though, you know, all signs point to not coming, you know,
right.
Not coming. I thought this whole thing was fascinating. I really encourage you guys to read up on this. Love it how this show manages to always pull in something that you're like, I had no idea that was a thing. I feel like the writers must spend like a great deal of time on Wikipedia looking up like what are the most unknown and freaky facts. But then how they tie it all in is miraculous at times. The main thing that I thought was wild was that the Millerites, these are the people who were part of the Great Disappointment, that actually began in upstate New York, a.k.a.
kind of where Mapleton might be.
And that message spread across the world. And actually, another big point for them was when it reached Adelaide, Australia. Woo! We know from social media that they're heading to Australia. We know that. But even if you didn't, you could have picked up along the way here that Kevin's dad had moved to Australia. You can remember from last season when there was like the dad with like the Aborigines dancing around in his hotel on his side. There was a lot going on there.
The Tower Man's letter.
Yep.
And the radio playing the report of the guy that came out of the cave after being missing for however long. That
all
was
in Australia. Yeah. I mean, I just think it's amazing that a real thing. And this, so far as we understand, the idea of going with the Great Disappointment and using this as a part of the story wasn't there since season one, episode one. So the idea that they like managed to find these things and weave it in the story, amazing, completely amazing. So let's go over some of the topics that did come up in this episode that we think are going to drive the remainder of the season. I read an article that Damon said that basically the entire season three was going to be sprinkled with what would be considered the finale, because I'm sure, as all of us feel, number eight is never going to be long enough for us. Episode eight could be, they could say, awesome, it's a 10-hour episode. And we'd be like, only 10 hours. So he said, you know, there was no reason to wait until number eight to start wrapping the story. So having said that, that scene with Nora and denying Kevin, I think, could have played out in episode eight, but I'm glad that they're going to start chunking it in to all these episodes as we go. And I think we're going to get not only little bits of what you would consider the wrap up, but I think we're going to continue to wrap up everyone else's stories.
Okay.
So there were a couple little nips that we got along the way here, like Lily.
Yeah.
What? I mean,
they can't just leave it with what they've done, because
she was so important.
Half of the first season was dedicated to her.
The finale of season one was all about them like making that connection, you know, on the porch.
And then season two, she wasn't so big, but I mean, she had major scenes in like the finale. And it was a major deal of keeping Nora, I think, kind of focused on what she wanted to be doing with her life.
Well, and Tommy's entire story was revolving around the pregnancy of Lily.
Protecting
her. Yeah, everything. So we can't just abandon that. So we're positive that that topic is moving forward. We're going to kind of separate this segment from the idea of actual predictions. But right now, these are storylines we think are definitely going to move forward. So we're moving to Australia. We know that. Kevin's dad, I think, there was a lot of nods to him within the story. Like you were mentioning, the Tommy's 25th birthday party mirrored a lot of the chief's senior's birthday party. And most especially, I thought, when I really thought about it, the fact that it was a surprise that wasn't a surprise.
Uh-huh.
And there was a lot of banter about like, well, it's 5:30 works better for me. And like, shut up, just be, you know, like, you know that it's a surprise party. Like down to all those small details, it was the same thing, you know?
It was.
That was kind of amazing. Are we going to get any more information about Erica? We just got the little nip, basically. I mean, like, we know that John and Lori are together. I don't think we're going to get much more on John and Lori being together, except for just to sort of be like, yep, now they're together.
Jardin's a small town, and if she didn't leave town, then we might run into her, because that's just the way things work. Or maybe Michael visits with her, or maybe she comes to church or something. I don't think we're done with Erica Murphy. But I think we'll get, like Caroline was just mentioning, something a lot like the bow tie that Damon wants to give some of the lesser plot lines before the finale.
And the thing is that Regina King as an actress certainly does not deserve to be like a complete throwaway storyline. So I really feel like Erica will get something here. I'm not sure exactly how or where or why, but I agree with you. There isn't any reason that Erica would have left town, honestly. Her father was right. There.
She and her whole family had always been there, if you remember her story.
They said it over and over, yeah, that she'd always been there. So that brings us to the town itself, like Jardin, whether it's magic or not magic. And is there some magical property happening there? I think that we are going to get, at least at the beginning part here, they are going to try to delve into that again, about the sort of the town itself being a character. We have a couple little threads there, like Mary wanting to leave the town, Kevin not being able to die in the town. Will either of them or anybody suffer any fate by crossing over the town lines?
Right.
I think they're going to test that.
Mary's already got an ETA on testing that. I can't wait to see how that turns out. That's going to be one of those kind of nail biter kind of scenes.
So then there was another one with Nora when she came and addressed the police department and was like, you know, if a guy says he has a body in the car and asks for a lawyer, get him a lawyer. If he mentions departure, the D word, you call for Nora. Departures, the concept of departures, we had really kind of put that on the back burner last season. There was a lot of concern about it in the first season, but last season we didn't talk about like the imminent departure.
But we did have all that discussion of secondary departures.
Absolutely.
And how Nora thought that they were 100% bullshit.
100% agree. But there was less like, obviously like Nora wasn't like this, wasn't like, if you hear about a departure, call me, you know.
I bet it's department policy or something, you know, like something that she's supposed to say just to remind them that there's, like she said, there's a process to follow. Especially with the anniversary coming up, there's probably more kind of skittish uncertainty everywhere, not just Jardin.
I would think so. So things that I don't think that we're going to get a ton more information on, Jill's story, as much as she was a big part. I mean, I think that her moving on to
school
and kind of having a life to herself, I don't know how much more we're going to really see.
That says a lot already. That second season, she turned around and became kind of a human being again. And third season, apparently, she wants to have a future.
Again. Yeah, wanting to do more. So I do agree with you. Like things like people are bringing up, like, are we going to find out about Nora's cast? I don't think so at all. I think that moment and even like Lori and John being married, I feel like those are kind of the things that are like, well, you just plunked down 3 years later. So if you just plunked down in my life next Wednesday, I'm not going to sit there and tell you what happened 6 weeks ago. Like the point was you just got here this Wednesday and you're going to pick up right here on Wednesday. And people had stuff going on. And I feel like some of those things like having the cast on or the fact that we missed a whole like courtship and marriage and stuff. It's just like, yeah, you did. And we don't have to right. We don't have to fill that in for you in order to be like good storytellers. That isn't how this is. You are supposed to be a part of real lives and stuff would have naturally happened in these people's lives.
Right.
Doesn't mean we have to tell you. And I want to shy away from the concept of those being then, quote, unanswered questions or not again, not like Lost. They have all these questions they left out there. Lost is a little bit different because there were stories that we were a part of the whole time. And a question happened within our time of the show, and then we didn't get an answer. That's one scenario. But bopping in 3 years after and not getting the what happened in those 3 years, that's not really an unanswered question. That's a time jump.
Yeah.
And you don't.
And you are getting the answer. You just may not be getting the question, actually.
Right. Or at least all the full details.
Right.
And it's not, they're not owed to you, is what I'm trying to say. Like, I don't feel like you should be able to hang your hat on, like, no, fair. That's an unanswered question. Why she has a cast. I mean, nobody said we would tell you every single deets.
Now, if they showed up and, like, Matt was an atheist,
I'd want to know.
We'd need some backstory.
I'm with you. I'd want to know. So, all right. So on to predictions now. And I know we kind of muddled our just like ongoing topics, but Lily's story, is she alive or dead, Paul? What do you think?
I think dead.
I'm going to say alive. And I don't know if she's with Erica. And I don't know if she's got a different situation going on. I don't know. She doesn't feel dead to me. I don't know why she doesn't feel dead.
Okay.
How will the move to Australia happen? What is going to get them up and going to Australia?
I think it's going to have something to do with Kevin's break with reality, he's going to convince everybody that that's what they have to do, that there's something having to do with his dad, and there's something that they have to do, but he can't really explain it much better than I'm doing right now. It's just sort of like, well, Kevin's the chief and he hasn't got us killed yet, so I guess we follow him.
Do you think that Kevin's dad actually initiates the move, or Kevin does? Because the only reason why I say, and especially, I mean, we're always going to tie some lost stuff. I mean, if you remember, he had to go in order to get his dad's body, right?
From Australia.
Mm-hmm. And so, and he was like called upon, if you kind of will, to come and get his father. Is it possible he's going to be called upon to come get his father? Maybe not in any way being called a dead father, but is there going to be something there where he is being obligated to go get or help his father in some way?
That'd be pretty compelling. Kevin Sr. said that he went to Australia to restart the world. Before that, he had told Kevin that he needed to, I forget his exact wording, but it was basically step up to the plate. It was time to enter the game. And I could see where now a call to action would be right in line with what, I mean, if he started the world 3 years ago or got it going, whatever he thinks, then now it might be time. Obviously, with the anniversary coming up, there's no better time.
So Book of Kevin, that was like brought out, and there was a lot of hinting as if he was like, or I should not even say hinting, like he was acting like he was going to burn it. Never thought he was going to burn it. Always knew this thing was going to travel around.
I think he's going to read it.
So he's going to read it. Is anyone else going to read it? Is this going to affect anybody else? What's going to happen here? What's up with this? I know they showed it. This was in the preview for next week. How did Nora end up with it in her hands? Did Mary take it from Matt and then get it to Nora maybe on her way out? How would that have happened? I know Kevin had it. Do you think Kevin just leaves it somewhere in the house and she finds it?
Carrying on with the, I'm just going to blurt out what's happening to me version of Kevin that we got in season two. I think he's going to go home and say, Matt wrote a book about me. He's not, and it's not going to be like the sort of thing where she just finds it.
I don't know. In that little preview thing, she holds it up and is like, oh, I was looking for some light reading. And she holds it up in a way that makes him be like, ooh, like he had it under his pillow or something, or up in the cufflink box. Well,
that would be a change. I mean, remember his policy last season was,
oh, yeah, no, he's like, hey, I'm crazy.
Right. I've been seeing Patty.
I love that. Like, you've been seeing.
I've been seeing someone.
Right. I love that. Love it. I love their dialogue. All right. So will Jardin turn out to be magic or not magic? And will Mary die and or have any horrible fate if she leaves the town?
I don't think she'll die, but I do think it's magic. I mean, we saw the birds come back to life. We saw Kevin come back to life. We saw her come back to waking. In this universe where people can disappear, I believe that there are also magical places. And I think Australia is going to turn out to be another little nexus of mysticism for us.
What do you think about like the concept of like additional departures? Is it possible that they're being called to Australia because there was a departure?
I wouldn't see that coming. I mean,
they would have been going for Nora's work then, I guess, not because a dad called.
Her job sounds federal. I think the Aussies would have their own departure specialist, but I'm not going to dismiss that at all. They very intentionally made her part of the DSD, and they very intentionally made her continue that in Jardin.
And especially like reminded us, like it's not like they dropped it and they didn't bring it back up again until it matters later. It's like, I mean, she was right starting the third season here, like, hello, everyone, making her spiel, you know?
Yeah.
So for sure.
Dressed up in a little suit and everything.
Little suit. Stop. Okay, well, so I have one big prediction question for you.
Lay it on me.
Okay, so given that we know this is the third season, and given that they absolutely have no reason to not wrap this up in the most final of all ways, will the world end in episode 8?
I have this horrifying thought that they're going to just do a David Chase screen goes to black kind of ending. It's going to be like, ah! But would I be completely surprised if that happened? Not exactly. I mean,
So you're trying to say that like they may get right on the end of the diving board of whether or not the world is about to end and then just go to black and not let us know. And then we all have to guess, did the world end or didn't it for all these characters?
Yeah, I could see that as an ending.
But I mean, we know
a lot of the actors said that they were satisfied with the ending.
No, I thought that even they hadn't seen really like how it all exactly worked episode 8. I thought they said they were all going to gather to watch it together. I know, editing rooms are tricky like that. And so you know, what actually airs and what actually happens.
That's a good point. Maybe the actors must have only been speaking about their own experience with what they filmed.
Right, where their character should have ended.
Yeah.
In theory, at least, right? I mean, no one can know because, I mean, screen's going to black. You can't know as the actor that they're going to cut you off. You might have said a whole spiel, but really, you know, they put like a smoke monster over your head that you didn't know was coming behind you in the effects room.
Like Nora had that happen to her in the first season when she came down and saw the body replacements for her family. The actress apparently screeched like she'd never done before, but they didn't use it. They just used her face and all that kind of stuff, but they didn't use the sound. They used music instead.
And so and that changed the entire feel of the event. Is there anything else that you feel like that is worthy of a prediction at this point?
Worthy of a prediction.
Is Kevin going to keep it together here?
No, I think my theory on going to Australia hinges on him starting to lose it again.
The concept of there being other worlds, like, you know, the International Assassin Hotel, makes me feel like, is it losing your mind if it actually exists and it's all there and you really did it? And it does change the real world when you come back. Well, have you lost your mind, or are you just living?
The effect of living through that on a normal human mind,
right,
could drive it to madness.
But here's my question. If you live as if there's multiple planes and you've legitimately, within this storyline, been to multiple planes and you've changed the world because of it, are you crazy if you then lead your life as if there is?
You wouldn't be, but you wouldn't be faulted for going crazy either, because you weren't born and brought up and have the training and anything to go through that. And you can see where Kevin's mind is having trouble reconciling what's real and what's not, because it all might be real. You know, there was never any kind of answer what Patty actually was.
Right.
You know, was it in his head? Was it a ghost? Never answered, never going to be.
So I wonder, I guess there's a differentiation between, like, I know what you mean from a science fiction point of view. Like sometimes when they time travel or something, like there's actually like deterioration of their brain or like something like that, where they kind of lose their mind. And I guess like another way to look at it is, if you are living on the same level that we are here, the same plane, and you're talking about the hotel where the dead people are hanging out, then it kind of doesn't matter to us as the rest of the humans whether or not your brain has actually deteriorated or not. We think you're crazy because you're talking about all this other stuff. So like within our plane, you're acting crazy.
Right.
So then I don't know if it matters. Like one or the, you know what I mean? Like
you still end up crazy.
Right. You're still perceived as crazy either which way. Right. So it could definitely happen.
It reminded me of actually watching Kevin a little bit this episode, especially with the stuff relating to his sanity, the breaks with reality, how his dad sounded a little bit in the first season, how he would, you know,
kind of bust in on the scene with something asinine. And then,
well, no, that he was talking to somebody that wasn't there. And it's not the exact same thing. Kevin didn't do that this episode. He did that a lot last season. But in this episode, what he did do was confuse one place for the other, basically.
And
that seemed to be something that Kevin Sr. was doing, like confusing.
Well, you're using the word confusing, and I'm going to like slow you down a little bit and just say, like, because we don't understand how these worlds work, it is plausible that he is existing in more than one place at a time. Like Michael never said his body left, you know, the premises or anything, but he was, you know, in another place. And not only that, but I thought about the suffocation part. And I thought, do you know what? We were only talking about it from our plane. What if when he does that, he actually goes and is gone for like a day and comes back? Because remember, an International Assassin, he was gone for several days, but he was only gone for Michael a couple of hours. So what if it's possible that he actually, like, when he suffocates like that, he actually goes to the hotel, he checks in, he like does like one little mission or something and comes back, kind of like guys, like, you know, sit down and play like a video game or something before they head out for the day. What if he does some crap like that? What if he's even talking to his dad through the TV? Like, what if he's like, I just need to call dad, hold on, and he like goes, puts the duct tape on his neck and is like and, like, goes to the hotel, does something there, and comes back, gets ready for work, and heads out. Is it possible?
It is possible, but I don't think that's what's happening. But that'd be so interesting if it was.
I'm going to be open to it because I feel like the way that they cut right off from that and then we just see him coming out the door, we don't have a good sense, really. It could have been 7 o'clock in the morning when he put that bag on his face because she said, it's really early, go back to sleep. And it could have been 3 hours later when he's heading out the door, or it could have been 5 minutes. But either way, right. We know that time is different at the hotel.
Yeah.
So we know he could have had like an overnight and still been back for work, you know?
On our webpage with this podcast, there's a link to Mimi Leader's interview where she talks about filming that scene. She was scared to death.
So they do finally explain how it all works. I'm so glad.
Yeah. Justin Theroux just did it.
Because you guys, it was happening, Paul and I, like, I kept asking him, like, how does this work? Like, from like a behind the scenes standpoint, like, is there like an oxygen tube that's like up the back of his neck that we can't see? Is there something that's
there? There was none of that. As far as they said, it was just more like they just kept the camera rolling. Justin did it as long as he could. And Mimi never called cut. Yeah, it was all Justin. And when he got his breath back, he said, do you need me to do it again? And she was like, no.
Oh, my God. That's so funny. Well, you know what? You know how sometimes, you know, specific characters affect people in a way? I kind of wonder if Justin Theroux as the actor is willing to say, like, do you need me to, like, you know, make it so I'm almost dead again? Like, it kind of... You know, I wonder if Justin and Kevin are maybe mushing together a little bit, you know?
Kevin is a very strong character.
It seems like somebody who would stick with you if you played that character for these years.
Yeah.
Well, I am super excited about the amount of social media that's out there. We're going to add a bunch on our website so that you guys can try to catch up. There are so many interviews that everyone has been doing. I swear they go like point by point these days and give you all the backstory. So like if you enjoyed things like How in the World... Did they film the scene where an actor actually has a bag over his face in the duct tape? How does that all work? Man, come and check out our website and we promise to add it. And we promise to add those behind the scenes pictures that we took when we visited Lockhart and you get to see all that stuff. We cannot wait for this next episode. If you guys have any questions, we are on Twitter and we live tweet during the shows and we love to interact with everybody. So come on over. We're Daily Review. It's DALEY. Review on Twitter, and we are on there more than we're on the Facebook page. So if anything, come hit us up on Twitter.
See you next week.
Catch us on iTunes or your preferred podcast software, our website, dailyreview.com, that's DALEY review.com, Facebook or Twitter, or wherever you find us. Please leave us a comment and a rating to let us know what you think of the show.
Thanks for listening, pod people. Thanks for listening to my mom and dad.
You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. Just go home, folks.